hot Paris. In the middle of our day of practice, at the end of our retreat in the heart of life, it was very interesting this morning to go out for a walk instead of sitting after the first period. I really, really liked it. We did the same thing during the writing and meditation retreat in Lisbon 3 weeks ago. No, we went out. The Buddhist Union is near the Fondation Gulbenkian, and so we went. We walked from the Buddhist Union about 5 or 10 minutes, and sat in the garden on a Saturday afternoon like this. It was just full of people and kids, and, but we sat next to the little lake, and just 15 minutes, you know, just it was going to be part of the writing exercise, but it was also a great practice of sitting just with what is. And and then when we came back and their exercise was to write what they had seen using a special formula, I mean, each sentence had to start with il y a in French. I forget what it was in Portuguese, but maybe you know. The equivalent of idea. It's a. Ah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And just, you know, do like a list. It's actually taken from a poem by Apollinaire, but I adapt it to writing groups. And it was really interesting to see, and everyone said that, because I had said, we're going out, we're walking, we'll sit for 15 minutes and then we'll walk back. So the whole thing was probably a little over a half an hour, 40 minutes maybe. And I said, just pay attention. I didn't say what we would do. I just said, observe, pay attention. And they all agreed that had they done that walk just on their own, just on a Saturday afternoon, they wouldn't have seen what they saw and experienced it in the same way. And I felt the same way today. If I had just walked from here to the Square Garde, to the Square Roquette and back, I wouldn't have experienced it the same way. And that this whole retreat of being in the heart of life has been with that in mind, of just you keep in mind that you're in this retreat and that then you see things differently when you're out there in your life and experience it differently. It was also very powerful for me to go to this Square Roquette, because when my daughter Morgane was about 2 years old and I lived in the Rue de Chahan, I went there with her a lot. I took her there often. And I think I've only been there once or twice since then. So this was almost 30 years ago. And one time we went when we were sitting at Joanne Delphine's, and Joanne Delphine were not there for some reason, and we didn't have the key and we couldn't get in. So we said, and I guess the paysagiste didn't want to let us in or something, I don't know, whatever it was. We didn't have the key anyway. And so I said, well, let's go sit in the park. So we went to the square. I keep wanting to say Square Gardette because there's another park where I used to go with Morgane, which is farther up by Saint-Amboise. But so we went there and we sat kind of, I don't know if you noticed, there was a man, at one point we walked way back around and there were two spots, kind of grassy areas with trees back. And there was a man at one of them lying down reading a newspaper. So, well, the one before that, there was a big tree and we sat there. And it was with Sophie, Christine, Freddy, and maybe Thomas. So this was a long time ago. But we sat there, we did our Monday night meditation there. So I had that memory, and then I had these memories of being a small child and the huge playground down there and the fountain, which she also liked to splash around in, and it hasn't really changed. However, my experience of it is different. Particularly today, being in the walking together silently with no real intention, we weren't really going anywhere, we were wandering, was very different than going there with a small child. And I could watch the parents today and see the man who had to chase after his little kid who was going to go out, and the other one that slipped in the water, and I could totally relate. So that was really, it was not planned. We just responded to circumstances. And it was perfect. And actually, that's what I love about this practice, which the only thing we have to do is respond to the circumstances, respond to the situation, respond to whatever arises, and it's fine. And we discover things that we wouldn't discover otherwise, but responding just to the situation without wanting the situation to be a certain way. If we had been fixed on this idea that we had to sit here for 2 hours, Kinyin, sit, Kinyin, sit, we wouldn't have had the freedom to just stand up and go out. Or we wouldn't have had the freedom to then appreciate what we experienced out there. And if we did the writing exercise of Ilya, it sounds better in French. In English, I don't really like it. I've done it with groups in English, and doesn't work in the same way. Ilya is kind of more poetic. I forget what it is. I did it in German, too. I forget what it is in German. Anyone?
That's it?
That's it, yeah.
Gibt.
Yeah. That's it, exactly. It sounded good when in the German when they were reading it. I mean, it had a nice sound to it. Whereas in English, it doesn't. Doesn't really work. Anyway, it would be interesting to see what we came up with. You know, the 10,000 things, and we all saw different things. And I had my phone with me because I wanted to take pictures. I always like to take pictures in the street when I'm walking. And then I didn't because I thought, no, just, you know, like there was a pair of shoes that was on a pillar. And then there was another pair of shoes in the park by the trash bins. I was also surprised to see all of the recycling and trash bins in the park, actually, and big things, you know. That was not there 25 years ago. So that's really our practice. Not to withdraw from the world, but to go into it. And lately I had some sort of awakening about the planet, and realized, I think I've talked about this recently too, realized that I had been turning away from it, that I didn't want to look, that I didn't want to watch the horrible videos and read the evidence and hear all about, you know, the coming doom, and I didn't want to. But then I discovered a Buddhist book, a Buddhist Ekodharma, and it changed everything. It was like suddenly I had a grill through which I could approach it. And really look at it, what's happening, and not turn away. That's also a signal for me when I want to turn away from something. That's a signal that that's what I really need to look at. I've learned through my practice. And that has changed, therefore, the way that I see even the practice that we do, you know, that. That we focus so much on individual awakening, and yet what is called for in this moment now is collective awakening, because the whole society is attached to itself and its blind desires and greed and anger and ignorance. And so it has to be something much more than just individual awakening. And so that's, you know, one of the ways that I feel is going into the world, not withdrawing from it, not turning away from it. That's also the way that we awaken, but it's also the way that we can have some impact on society awakening as well. And I'm continually inspired, as usual, by Bernie Glassman and his approach to see that here he was in this beautiful Zen community that he created in a mansion in the nice part of town, overlooking the Hudson River with these fabulous views or whatever, and realizing that, you know, 10 minutes away in the inner city, people were dying of AIDS, living on the streets, crack, heroin addiction, single mothers, no employment. And he said, wait a minute, what are we doing? What are we doing? And realized that that was what the practice was to go, to respond to the circumstances. And I think that each of us can look into our lives, and what does that mean? First, we have to look at our lives and dive into them, and that's what this week has been about. It's like, go into your life and see your life really as it is, and see it at that, that is your material for practice. Someone said, Scott, my Dharma brother, some of you know Scott from England. I remember once he said, because he lives in the north of England, he has two kids, he has a job, he has a wife. At the time, I think he only had one child. She was very young. Now he has two, but... So it was hard for him because he... to maintain his practice. There was no group where he lived. If he wanted to go to a group, he had to drive like a half an hour to Sheffield or something, and, or, you know, an hour to Liverpool or whatever it was. And it was a long schlep to get to Paris, and he couldn't come very often because he had a job and he had a kid and a wife, and his wife didn't practice and all of this. And he would come to summer retreat like for 1 week. And I remember him saying once, or telling me, I forget if it was in a circle or if it was, he told me this or in a conversation, I don't know, that he said, he had a kind of shift when he said, am I willing to really live my life as it is? That's the thing he had to let go of, was like wishing that his life was different. And I'm not sure he wished that it was different, but it made it harder by the fact that he felt this like pull in two opposite directions. And he said something like that. He said, am I willing to really plunge into my life as it is and live it fully? Meaning, go to work. I think he worked like in an insurance company or something. And I'm still not really clear what he does. Do you know what he does?
I try to understand, but yeah. It was very unclear to me.
What I understood is that they go around and see that people don't, they write down how long people take to go to the bathroom and stuff so that it goes better.
Right, you know? Efficiency thing.
Yeah.
Consultancy,
he wasn't
efficiency.
This was years ago, but he wasn't thrilled about it at all because it's not very nice. I mean, you guys have been talking for 10 minutes.
Well, and then I think he, you know, he kind of moved up the ladder, and he was supervising a team, and, you know, he now I'm not sure what he's doing, but anyway. It was not like, you know, his life's passion, I don't know, the work that he was doing. I never really heard him complain about it, but, and he had a small child, and he had his wife, and, you know, she didn't like it if he was gone all the time, and we can all, those of us in couples can relate to that. And he said, so am I willing to really do this, to really live it? And that was his kind of shift of life and practice as one. That he realized that what he had to let go of was his idea that this was not his practice, that his practice was something else. And then he had another child and started his own sitting group and invited me to come once and lead a weekend workshop. And now next year we'll receive the transmission from Roshi. So are we willing to do it? Are we willing to plunge in and live our life as it is and see it as it is? And, you know, I would almost say make the best of it, but it's already the best. It doesn't have to be, you don't have to make it anything other than what it is. It doesn't mean that things can't be changed, you know. We have to, in a house, you have to, you know, we have to change the, we have to insulate the floor in the attic so that we have better energy efficiency, or the house that I bought was small and we expanded it and renovated it. Doesn't mean that the house as it was not perfect, so we have to just stay in it and live, four of us in three tiny rooms. No. Saying something is as perfect as it is doesn't mean that we can't change it. That's the thing. And I think probably, if we take Scott's example, he probably, as his children grew older, it was easier for him to be away more often. As he grew in his work and got higher, better paying positions, he could allow himself to go more often on retreat because financially it was acceptable. I don't know. And now I think his children have done Jukai, actually. I'm pretty sure they both did.
That rings a bell. Doesn't it? Talking about last year.
Yeah. And I think they're like, you know, 13 and 11 or something like that. Or 14 and 12 or something like that. His wife? No, I don't think so. She came, I think, when the children did the Jukai, and but she's not involved in the practice, except she accepts that the sitting group that Scott has is in his garage. So I think they, you know, had to forego the garage and transform it into a sitting zendo. And so are we willing to do it? Are we willing to plunge into it? We were this week, you know, all of you except for one, well, because for reasons that are very unusual nowadays, not having any access to internet made it impossible for one person to do the retreat. But otherwise, all of you here were involved in the retreat. And,
well, he was as well.
He was as well, I mean, in the sense that he didn't sign up for it, that's what
right.
I mean. Yeah. But he was.
You
exactly, good point.
You could have signed up anyway.
Yeah.
Yeah, but then I thought I can't contribute, so it was a little bit...
Yeah. But you're right, he was in it too, because we were. Yeah, that's right. And there were 50, technically, you know, concretely, there were 51 people signed up and participating in the retreat actively on three continents, as I said. And I kind of lost count of the number of countries, but I think 10 maybe. And I didn't count the nationalities. So many, many people did not contribute on the blog, but that's okay. And just the fact of doing it, I know for me it's a really strong practice. It involves a lot of work for me, but it's a strong practice to do it and feel that I'm holding this retreat space and making it possible, and that it's very, very powerful for me to know that people are with me. And I didn't come here and sit in the mornings, but I sat in my garden in the mornings, and that was really nice. Something I don't do every day otherwise, and it was great. So any participation? Anyone want to say anything about the walk or the retreat or anything else?
What I really love about this retreat, and it's very strong for me too, is to think that when I'm on my train going home and everybody's hot and screaming, people screaming, their telephones on the ground, oh, we're all on retreat together now, aren't we? So it gives me a good giggle at the same time, that it can be very strong with people that I know to tell them that. So as I mentioned on the blog, somebody called and said, oh, I don't want to interrupt you if you're on retreat. I said, no, that's not that. Now you're on retreat too, so they get into it.
Well, and this morning, some of you crossed someone who said, oh, are you...
This woman and I keep... I have crossability, but Allison, she's been here.
I know, I've recognized her.
She lives in the neighborhood, and they're doing a dance thing in... she dances with a dance teacher that I dance with in Vincennes, to whom I wrote and said I can't come because I'm doing a Zen thing. So she made all... because she was very quick to notice that we were doing something.
So she's part of the retreat.
With the walk, I'm always mesmerized about the diversity of activities. What do people do in their free time? And when you have a buffet, I always have that thing. It's like, oh, everyone has preferences and no plates are the same. People pick different things and they just make something different. And you had all kinds of activities there going on.
So what were some of the activities we noticed?
Yeah, there was one guy doing Qigong or Tai Chi. There was like all these kids playing around. They were lovers. They were like people reading. One guy watching his phone. I loved also it reminded me of William and Alain, that with the little kid just walking in one direction, and then the dad at some point just puts his shit in the other direction, and the kid starts to run in the other direction. That was really funny. The gardener, the people walking the dogs, and
washing the dog also.
Right.
Getting him wet.
The dog's paw in the bowl. Yeah.
Talking to one another.
Some woman like studying her cours.
Right.
And that little girl, when she came up, she saw the activity. She took off her purse, so like, here, hold this. She didn't. Her father grabbed her just as I saw her in a split second. It was like, oh, that's a great activity. I'm way in there. It was so fast.
In the fountain there.
Right.
Yeah.
Kind of does make you want to go in there.
And the other thing also, when you talked about collective awakening, during this week we studied, so the Satipatthana, one of the texts in the sutras, and there was one passage that when we talked about the factors of awakening, what helps us to awaken, So there are like seven factors listed, and whatever investigation of the Dharma and Sati and all that. And there was, and I realized, like, for me, there was one element that was actually missing for me in that list, which was the Sangha, the people. Because I realized, I mean, just this is our first factor of awakening. This is the people we meet, actually. The experiences we get from people, the rubbing with one another, for me, I thought, from all these elements that were mentioned for me, that's like, there was one, the one missing for me that was, which I thought was very important. So that kind of links to the collective awareness also.
And was that discussed? Did you bring that up and then it was a discussion of why it wasn't on the list or no?
I did share that at some point in at the end, very end of the closed circle. And then I talked to the teacher about it and I was like, oh, why is that missing? I mean, I thought this is very important. And he said, well, as all those lists and those Buddhist teachings, you know, they're not necessarily complete. They're not exhaustive, you know, all the various elements. It's just like a map, and then you see it in various other lists, like what we have, you know.
The three treasures.
The three treasures, exactly. It's in the three treasures. It's like, it's the third treasure of the three treasures. So it's there. It's one of the others. They all have lists. So this was just one list, you know, among others. But I think that links very much for me to the collective awareness, to the collective awakening. And collective awareness. There is no obviously awakening without awareness. Which is the first actually element mentioned in that list of awakening factors of the mindfulness, the sati element.
It's so funny, I don't have any green clothes, but I love all the different greens. In any one sort of blob of bush, tree, leaves, flowers and stuff, they're like four or five different, they're probably more, but to my eyes, shades of greenness, and it's fabulous.
Also the trees, some of the trees in the street were completely the flowers, and I realized that it's not something that I pay attention to very much, the blossoming of the trees in Paris. I see the trees, but I don't necessarily see them at this very precise moment where there's actually when it's actually blossoming. I've really learned to appreciate with the country house the fact that the blossoming is very short period in the year, so if you really just miss this crucial 2 weeks, that's it for a year.
Yeah. Well, and as someone said on the blog, I forget who it was, she's been watering her plant and wait, because last year there was a fabulous flower that came, and this year there's going to be two, and she's been watering it and waiting for it to happen, and suddenly she realized she wasn't going to be there when it blossoms, because she's going on vacation. And it's like that, you know, it's like, okay, well, if you miss it, then it's going to be
Delphine is always,
right.
Is always sad when we're not going to be away for that particular moment, when those particular trees in the back garden are blossoming, it's beautiful.
The impermanence, you know, and really then appreciate it entirely, because it's fleeting. Really appreciate it. And yeah, all those, there were so many flowers in the park too. It was just amazing. And then there's this little kind of like community thing on the corner there where people plant their own stuff. Is that what it is? It's like a
Shared garden.
It's like in the street down the corner there. Yeah, which was,
yeah, there are more and more of those.
Oh, interesting. Huh. And those flowers, you know, in a few weeks. I know the roses in my garden are already gone, most of them. They bloomed and then there were big rainstorms or something and they got wiped out.
This year I've paid special attention, special care to the seasons and what I was eating, depending on the seasons, to really buy just what's seasonal. I was very, and then it struck me the other day when I realized that if you really stick to that, well, it's changing all the time, but there's not a lot of a huge variety of things.
Mm.
And then, but then you're like, so you have to enjoy it for the moment.
Mm.
And then something else comes up, and then, you know, the mushrooms disappear, but then something else arrives, and it's not a huge amount of ingredients. I mean, my compass is the little shop on the street, Roots. This is where mostly I buy this stuff, and I know that it's seasonal. I know it's rather local, so, but it's, yeah, the diversity is not great, but it's moving all the time, so it's very interesting.
Well, and if we all do that,
yeah,
exactly,
makes me really, really appreciate the what I, you know, that particular vegetable or strawberry that I'm going to eat just for a few weeks. And it's
exactly
like the flowers.
Yeah.
I was very strongly aware when I was coming here this morning that I love l'imprévu that I create, but I don't like l'imprévu that's not under my control, basically. And I had a whole movie of what was going to happen when I got here. You guys were going to be here, first of all. Would you like some coffee? No, I've already had a cup. I had the whole dialogue going. There was nobody who was like, what are you doing? And I thought you weren't late or anything. It was like, but my movie, how can, where are the characters? And I'm like that a lot, and it can be absolutely not important. I mean, it was no big deal. This sort of what attitude towards fate or whatever it is that makes it never happen the way you think it's going to. It only works when, if I go on a trip and say, oh, well, I'll just do anything I want, or I'll take any route I want, then it's me. But most of the time it's not me, and then I'm grouchy, basically, when it's not my movie. It's kind of a disappointing realization. When you get right down to it, you know, all this practice to find that out.
Yeah, but that's already huge to find that out, because...
That's the good news, you know. That's
right, absolutely. Right. That's true. Because usually we don't, you know.
I can't understand why I'm so grouchy. I'm so grouchy in my head. And I like my life and I like the people around me. I'm happy, I'm in good health. I'm always kind of, what?
Yeah. And realizing that is that's the good news, in the sense that yes, it's this, so that allows us to then become more and more aware of it and see then what's behind that, and then we become free from it. Because we realize, wait, I don't have to do that. No, I don't. Like today when we decided to go for a walk, it was kind of, well, if we had stuck to our, what we, if we all had our ideas, I mean, in your movie, that was not part of the movie. That scene didn't exist, right?
I got the movie in when I got here, but...
Right.
The first part being a flop. No more movies.
Well, then another movie starts.
And also, I like you, so you can lead me into another movie. Had you been someone else, I could probably would have done the whole walk saying, no, but who do they think they are? Changing my life.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah, it depends too. So how do we respond to circumstances that arise? Yeah, it's whew. Yeah. And we realize how much energy we devote to trying to make it be some other way. Or being unhappy when it isn't like we want it. And then result, like you say, crabby and grouchy and then not being nice to people. I mean, that's not even about being nice, but it's just that, you know, transmitting that grouchiness to someone else and whatever.
It's not their fault, but you may be part of it.
Exactly, that's right.
You said something about when you don't want to look at something, you know that's where you need to go. When you know that, if you don't want to go there, but you know you need to go there, how do you do it if you're still resisting? How do you crack it?
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing. It's, well, from my with my example of the economic crisis.
But something more personal. Like, I don't know, dealing with stuff or, for example, during this retreat, I was doing a work retreat to start out with, so it was kind of complicated. But then I didn't have any time for myself. But also, later, when I came back, Thursday and Friday, I could see I wasn't engaging fully. I could see it. I know.
Engaging fully with what?
With the retreat.
Okay.
And I couldn't go more into it. And then sometimes it happens with the practice. I stay a bit withdrawn, or with other stuff like anger. It's something that I know I have, and I just don't. How do you put your energy into that and going, making it naked, whatever it is?
Well, I mean, the first step is not turning away from it.
Yeah.
So staying with it, I used my example of the echo crisis because it's the same thing applies. It's like, for years I turned away. I didn't look at the stuff. I didn't want to hear about it. And people were talking about it. And I was like, yeah. I recycle, I do compost, and I take public transit instead of driving a car, and, you know, whatever. But at some point, something shifted, in the sense that I didn't... first, I had to realize I was turning away from it, and that took a while for me to realize it. And, you know, maybe with this kind of stuff, too, is... to what extent are you really aware that you're turning away from it? I mean, to what extent is it just that your habit is to not look at it, and I'm angry and I'm frustrated and I don't like that, but okay, you know, and then you move on to something else, whatever. So this, the really acknowledging that I'm turning away is important. It's an essential part of it, because then you're almost one with it. You're really not moving away from it when you acknowledge that you're not, that you're moving away from it. See what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And then there is no fixed way of. I mean, I'm sure there are practices in the Zen tradition. We don't work like that, but I'm sure, you know, in Vipassana or in other traditions, they have like really methodical things that you do, chants that you do, and, you know, things step by step, and you work through it, and you do this and that and that and the other, and, you know, like the sutras that have like really precise stuff, and you look at this aspect and you look at that aspect, and and then we don't do that. We say just stay with it, which ultimately comes to the same place, because they're just, these other things are just, they're giving you a map, like you say, to stay with it and help you to break it down into parts that might help you break through it. It's not a guarantee, though. Because even those step-by-step things, it's not a guarantee. Because in those step-by-step things, you also have to be one with it. You have to really do it. You know, in the breathing thing of, you know, just following your breath, which is, in Zen, it's like super basic. In the, on a, how do you pronounce it? Anapanasati Sutra?
There is the Anapanasati Sutta and the Satipatthana Sutta.
Right, but the Anapanasati
Sutta is the one about
the breath one.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's super, super elaborate. I know about this from my husband, who's like, you know, could talk for hours and hours and hours about it, and says, oh, nobody else gets it. You know, all these people who say they practice it, they don't know how it is. You get the real transmission and all this stuff. I mean, I'm not criticizing, it's just I don't know anything about it. All I know is breathe in and breathe out. And it's the universe breathing. It's not me breathing, it's the universe. And it's me, and I'm the whole universe, you know. But when you do that practice, that's not... Eventually, I think you come to that point. But it's super elaborate, and you have alternate breathing, and you focus on it. I don't even know all the stuff, you know, that's in it.
Je pense que chacun finalement a trouvé l'outil qui lui convient le mieux. Moi je sais quand il y a des choses que je ne veux pas voir et que j'accepte de regarder, ce qui m'aide beaucoup c'est d'écrire. Je ne sais pas du tout ce qui va venir, je prends le crayon, je suis avec ça et il y a une part de moi qui écrit, et y a, les choses se démêlent, ça c'est clair.
Hmm. Oui, c'est sûr. Ça, c'est chacun, everyone finds their own thing.
For me, what seems central also in what you're saying, there are two things, I find there are two parts. One is going back to our intention. It's always a good thing. Like, what do we truly want? What are we trying to cultivate here? Because that kind of leads the investigation. And then also there's a gentleness that is required towards oneself. And so maybe sometimes it's just also, what do we need? It's like, I'm not doing something, but you know, that it's that I feel I should be doing because this is the practice, but actually my body requires something else, so I need something, I need that space, and I'm just, this is not appropriate. I mean, I really appreciated when I arrived at my retreat last week, I was exhausted, didn't even notice how exhausted I was until I got there. And then there were a lot of instructions that were given, like as you said, very detailed, and I shared at some point, it was just too much, like too detailed, it was like, and I said to them, you know, fuck it, I just want to walk, just not, you know, doing all the step by step. And they said, and it was very, they were very encouraging. It's like, but because this is what you need, you know, for the moment, you can't deal with it, you can't cope with it. So, yeah, fine, just do the walking meditation without doing the step by step thing, and doing what I usually do, like what we did today. And so that was very important, that was very interesting to, okay, I need to listen to the body, I need to listen to more carefully to actually, what do I need? You know, it's like, that kind of shifts also the, okay, maybe I have ideas about what, you know, I should be more engaged in this form, in that form, but maybe this is not what I need right now.
Hmm. And maybe even, you know, like that whole should thing is
stinks.
Yeah, that's a way of saying it. But by being so Joa's way you described is you were fully engaged then in the practice by just walking.
Yeah.
You know, you were fully engaged.
Absolutely.
And maybe in your case, to be fully engaged in the retreat is to just acknowledge what is for you at that moment. I mean, you could even, that's even what you could put on the blog is, I'm
all
not.
All I can do.
Right, I don't feel like I'm engaged. And then you're fully engaged when you acknowledge that. And then, it's true, there's this gentleness in that too. It's like not, you know, being so like an Ayatollah that it has to be like this or that.
Yeah, I'm very grateful that in our lineage, compared to sometimes the kind of other Zen style, you know, it's like,
it was just like this gentleness that we need to have. And it's not just like the stick and then just sit straight, and if you move, just you're going to be smacked.
Mm.
All right. It's like, what do I need?
What is required by my body, by where I am?
That implies, however, being aware and being paying attention to your body, what you need. Like you said, you got there and you were just so tired and you hadn't realized it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's easy to get into a thing like that where you don't realize it. You're just so involved in your daily life. And you, I mean, I don't know in your case what happened, but...
Yeah, I mean, all the stuff that piled up since February, that it was just... yeah, that really taught me a lesson, like paying more attention to, like, protect oneself. Also.
First, or
protect
that
myself.
You can't
yeah.
practice. Yeah.
Absolutely.
Right.
Yeah, really.
Yeah.
And there's something
yeah.
very important that for me, there was a very important teaching, like protecting myself from the, you know, learning to say no, learning to say this is too much, learning to, yeah, there's a gentleness towards oneself.
Et une confiance en ce qui se passe en nous. Peut-être être consciente que voilà, maintenant je ne veux pas regarder ça, je sais qu'il faudra que j'aille, mais c'est pas donner du temps au temps. En gardant les deux, avoir l'intention, enfin, voir qu'il se passe quelque chose, qu'il y a quelque chose que je ne veux pas voir, mais quand ça sera le moment, je sais que j'irai. Il y a une espèce de confiance interne, je crois.
Yeah, trust. Yeah, absolutely. And that's also that too. To gain that trust, you have to really sit and be present to yourself and things coming and going. And when you do that, then you gain confidence in it, and you trust that, like you say, when it's the right moment, it'll be the right moment. And it takes practice to have that confidence too.
Repressed anger, you start going in there and saying, come out, I want to talk to you. You're going to get popped in the kazoo. I'll talk to you.
It's funny, during that work retreat, I auto-designated myself, also because of, I'm part of the coordination team, the timekeeper. I was the timekeeper and the silence keeper. During
because there was silence and
no, but during we had a lot of presentations and stuff and people talk, and so I kept going, you know, please, you know, quiet. And at times I stared at people and said, and why do I have to do that? You know, why am I the one always putting myself in these uncomfortable, not nice, but why do I do that? And timekeeper also because, you know, we were, well, because of my role in there in the institute, that's kind of, I have to deal with that kind of, you know, making sure everything happens correctly and that dealing with the people where, the location where we were. And so, you know, that said we need to be at that time for lunch, and then at some point I look at, oh shit, you know, we need to go, and sort of around everyone and said, okay, now eat, and it's, and you need to be, you know, now go, stop talking and go, because, you know, they're waiting for us, and I don't like the other ones to be, you know, we need to be respectful of the others as well. And so I end up being a cop, you know, like, and I was, and that's also the thing that I was observing is, why do, you know, why, it's much easier in our retreats, because, you know, you don't need to do the cop because everybody knows, is aware of the time and is aware of where we need to be at what time. And if you don't do things, then it doesn't happen. So it's collective. But in a lot of, you know, in there, people have, you know, they're just, ooh. Voilà. And so it's funny to see how in different environments, the same position, because I've been timekeeper before, and often am, takes a completely different flavor. And not very nice at times, because you're like, ah. So that was part of it, my retreat.
Hmm. And so you volunteered for that?
No.
Oh,
I
just it came with your
it just,
with your job.
Yeah, sort of
yeah.
expected of me.
Hmm.
Or maybe not. Maybe I just put myself in that position. But also the director wasn't there at some point. Often he also fixed that position, but he wasn't there, so someone else had to do it. And it's part of my role.
Probably, though, it's not by accident that you have that role.
No, probably not.
Because it's how we all, you know, we all have jobs and things that fit with what we do. And then that carries over into our life, too. And and it's always good to look at it. You know, if we look at, like, in the grill of the five Buddha families, that's very Vajra, keeping the time and being sure that it's, you know, on schedule. And
from someone who's always late.
That's interesting. That's true. That's very interesting, yeah. That's true. That's true.
It's good that you said it.
That's right. Yeah. That's true. We didn't say that.
I know.
I didn't even think it, actually. But that's true. But when you're timekeeper in that context or in the retreat context, you're not late.
No, because it's a collective thing.
Uh-huh.
It's not just me. It's different.
Uh-huh. Interesting. Yeah, that's
you
an interesting thing to look at.
You need to make everything work.
Right.
So I'm no longer there. It's just...
And
work.
So when you're late in other situations, you feel like it's not your responsibility, it's working without you?
Yeah, it can work, you know, if I'm not there, it still will happen.
Uh-huh. Interesting.
So I'm not responsible for it,
right.
Making it happen, so if I'm late, it's not as important.
Well, and that's very typical of the way we think, and I remember Roshi used to say this a lot, when people would leave the retreat early, or arrive late, or not come. You know, they would say they were coming and then they didn't come, they didn't show up, or whatever. And she would always say, people don't realize how important they are, and that they don't realize that the group is different when they're not there. Or in a circle, you know, when we have a circle, and then the cook gets up to go to cook or something and leaves the circle, it's different. The group is different. And if someone leaves the retreat early, it's the group is different. And so, you know, that kind of fits with what you're saying, that we feel like, well, it doesn't really matter if I'm there or not. Or it doesn't matter if I leave early.
So there's really a tension between, as you said, feeling tired and deciding to go to work, and just what you said. C'est vraiment une tension finalement entre à la fois être à l'écoute de soi-même, de savoir que voilà, j'ai besoin d'aller me balader parce que là j'en peux plus, c'est pas possible, et juste ce que tu viens de dire à l'instant. Apparemment, je dis apparemment, ça semble contradictoire. Après, il y a certainement un troisième terme à trouver, mais.
Maybe, you know, hearing you say that, maybe realizing that the group is different when I'm not there, not that it's bad or good, but it's different.
Okay, I'm going.
And maybe that can help me see more clearly what I need and when I need to do it.
And what I need, what I want to give.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
To who?
To yourself.
Yeah.
And to the others.
Yeah. But and also, I feel there is another aspect in what you're saying is like, also, but not seeing the fact that it does make a difference when you're not around, also it tells something about the how we view ourselves, how
yeah,
we view ourselves,
I mean, yeah,
as making a difference,
yeah,
or not.
Right.
Yeah, yeah.
And we maybe then will take better
and
care of ourselves because we respect that we are important to the group, you know,
mm,
in our presence. And
I had a girlfriend who is still a friend, actually, although she missed more rendezvous than I don't think I've ever had in my life. And she said, why are you nuts? She was either at least an hour late, or she'd call and she couldn't come, and blah, blah, blah. And she said that was the reason. I could think, oh, come on. I said, why are you doing
that? Was the reason what?
That she did not feel that it was important whether or not she was there,
mm-hmm,
or not.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, yeah, 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 I've heard this one before. But over time, now that I know her after 30 years, it's true. She isn't someone that has a real sense of her importance.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe she was afraid to show up on time. And what if Debbie's not there and then I'm really not important? Who knows how convoluted that is after it sets in your head. But it took me so long to see that she was saying, it's funny, if you're not important, be here on time. You know, it just
mm-hmm
seemed illogical in a way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It makes me think that I feel that even if it sounds illogical, if there is a pattern for the person, there must be a logic somewhere, even if it's twisted. It might be a twisted logic for the person, for the outside world. But there is an economy in it.
And there's a meaning for the
yeah
person. Yeah.
For sure.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
I mean, if there is a pattern, if there is, as soon as there is a pattern, there is probably some kind of advantage or benefit that the person gets out of it, whether or not she's aware of that advantage.
But from my point of view of being there on time, her behavior looks arrogant and distant,
mm-hmm,
whereas it's the opposite. So it's I now believe her because we've spent hours on the phone going over all of her problems. But
well, and you know, in some, our Zen group is much more flexible. But there was a time at Dana, and I don't know, most recently when there was a big retreat in Belgium with Dana, the Jikido would close the door when it was time for the period, and you were not allowed to enter after that.
Because I was never allowed.
What?
I guess I was never late. I wasn't.
No, I don't know if it's, and this was like only like 5 years ago or something, when in that big retreat in Belgium when it happened. Of course, there were like 100 people, and so if you had stragglers coming in and opening and closing the door, it was really a pain.
Mm-hmm.
But once Corinne and I and whoever was my Jisha, I think it was Sophie or something, we arrived like 30 seconds late, and the door was closed.
Ooh.
So we couldn't enter.
You mean closed, locked
no
on the inside?
No, but the rule
no,
had
the
been
rule
made.
No, the rule was if the
door is closed, you don't come in.
So you went in during Kinin? Or?
Right, so we sat outside and we went in during Kinin, and really, Roshi was really mad at us for being late. But we were like only 30 seconds late. You know? I mean, mad. She was like, why weren't you there? You know,
I mean, being with Chi, people drifted in and
yeah
out all the time. I was really annoyed
yeah
in the beginning. Because I have a hard time being on time. So when I get there, I want applause just about it. Like, I made it, you guys. What? You didn't try as hard as me? And there were lots. And I remember talking to her about it even. But I was fixated on it.
Yeah.
And since mainly it was Michelle.
Well, and
people
being late?
Not tons, but there were two or three people that, now maybe they were coming from the kitchen. Or
well, and there were also parents with little kids
yeah
who,
no,
you know,
no,
had to do stuff.
Had good reasons,
yeah,
but
yes,
I said,
Mathieu was kind
no
of like...
Sort of a Nazi about time.
Well, and once when I was doing a retreat with Bernie and Greystone in New York, some of us were staying off site, and you know, so we had to depend on other cars and other stuff to get there. And so Bernie too was staying off site, and so a group of us arrived, and they had the rule there. We were going to go in, and the guy who was the Chiquito kind of turned around and looked at us, and you know, you can't come in. So we said, okay. So we sat outside of the Zen home. We were sitting there, and Bernie arrived. And he looked at us sitting there, and he kind of laughed, and he said, oh, he said the guy's name, his Dharma name. whatever, you know, he said, oh, Daishin, or whatever his name was. Oh, looks like Daishin intervened, huh? And we said, yeah, he wouldn't let us come in. And he's like, oh, he's such a, it wasn't like Ayatollah, but it was something, you know, like that. Like, he's such a fundamentalist or something. But he stayed out there. We all stayed out there and sat, waited till they were done, until the kinin. I think in ZCLA it's still like that. Or probably in Oregon, you probably can't come in late, right?
That would have not even occurred to anyone.
Exactly. Because you don't do it.
It was...
No, you don't do it.
No.
Just,
no, it was, I mean...
No. So there's different degrees to which we have these things that how much, when we have the straight rules, you know, like you say, then there's this tension between, well, what I need, what I want, what, but really the rule, the ritual, the structure is put in place to help you realize what you want and need and not just fall into your attachments and your
mm-hmm.
patterns and... your, you know, self-indulgence or whatever it is. Because there are times really when you can't be there on time. But then you have stuff that, you know, someone in Portugal was in Lisbon recently was telling me, she sits regularly at the, because she likes to sit and there isn't so much available, she sits with the Deshimaru group in Lisbon. And she said, but it's, she sits in a chair because she has a problem with her leg or something. I don't know what it is, and but she so she can't sit in the zendo. She has to sit out in the hallway
mm-hmm.
because she's in a chair, mm-hmm. and that's like really. It's what she needs. She needs to sit in a chair, and fortunately, she's respecting that instead of forcing herself to sit.
And what they need is to be a little bit ridiculous about rules, I guess.
But she likes it because she likes to sit, and she feels like she's sitting with the group, even though she's in the hallway. Okay, well, we probably should end there.
It's almost 1:30,
yeah.
1:25.
So we will put this talk on the blog so people can hear what we did today. Okay.